sure your comments come on. But we have a good agenda, need to launch into that. Thank you for being here. First order of business is to start the roll around, and again, you can't leave unless your name's on the roll, so make sure you find it. If it doesn't get to you, raise your hand. We do have a big crowd today, thank you. Do we have any empty seats? So there's one back there.
There's two back there.
One over there, a couple over there, okay. You guys could direct people when they come in. If we have more, that'd be great. Let's go around the room quickly and introduce ourselves. Tom, can we start in the back with you?
I'm Tom Tripp, Fuller County.
Rob Parker, U.S. Magnesium.
Tommy Baldwin, Pacific Corp.
Chris Snapback, Division of Water Resources.
Craig Miller, Division of Water Resources.
Ann Kramer, Division of Wildlife Resources.
Tim Hawks, Branch and Cooperative.
Todd Adams, Utah Water Resources.
Candace Hassenegger, Water Resources.
Mika Roundy, Davis County.
Chris Montague, Nature Conservancy.
Ann Neville, Nature Conservancy.
Amy DeFreeze, Fish and Wildlife Service.
Marcel Shute, National Audubon.
Jen Streifel, Mika Women Voters.
Lynn DeFreitas, Friends of Great Salt Lake.
Brian Dixon, Richland Audubon, River Lane Conservancy.
Jeff Lukowski, Rio Tinto.
Teresa Cockey, Rio Tinto.
Chris Peterson, Observer.
David O'Leary, U.S. Geological Survey.
Christine Rumsey, USGS.
Corey Angeroth, USGS.
Jamie Barnes, Forestry Barrier State Lands.
Laura Ault, Forestry Barrier State Lands.
Jesse Stewart, Salt Lake City Public Utilities.
Jeff Dimbleiker, Jacobs Engineering.
Nick Scow, Utah Rivers Council.
R. Jeffrey Hicks, Utah Airboat Association.
Laura. Already went, right?
I already went.
Laura Vernon, Forestry Fire and State Lands.
Jake Vanderlaan, Division of Water Quality.
Jeff Scott, Box Elder County Commission.
Rand Elliott, Davis County Commission.
Waylon Myers, Stewart.
Joe Abbas.
Joe Abbas, Encompass Minerals.
Todd Leonard of the Great Salt Lake Branch and Cooperative.
Paula Sila, Jacobs Engineering.
Armin Manevra with Jacobs Engineering.
Tom Order representing municipalities.
Dave Livermore, Nature Conservancy.
Dan Tuttle, Tola County.
Jeff Richards, Migratory Bird Production Areas.
Thank you again for being here. We do have a quorum. There was an agenda provided in advance, and you have it in front of you. We had no suggestions for changes, so I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda. Thank you, Jeff. Is there a second? Thank you again, the other Jeff. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. You received an advance meeting notes of our meeting of March 13, 2019. We received no corrections, so we would entertain a motion to approve those meeting notes.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dan. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Randy. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? That's unanimous. I would thank Randy for allowing us to use your trample over your facility again. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Works
great. We'll get rooms right next time, right?
Yeah, right. We because of the size, we may, for the next meeting, move to another location, either downstairs on the first floor, which is where we announced we're going to be today. My bad. Or perhaps there's been a suggestion we should go out to the end of Glover Lane. It's called the Eccles. Is that what it's called?
Yep, Eccles.
Eccles Center?
Yep.
Since we haven't had a meeting there yet.
They've got a nice building, nice facility.
Second.
Was that a motion?
Yeah.
Don't tie us down, it's not available, man. Give us a show up there. So anyway, thank you, Randy. Thanks for this feeling. Your hospitality. Okay, let's start. We've made a practice at many of our meetings to have brief reviews of reports to the technical team. Great Salt Lake technical team is, by statute, a technical advisor to us. And today we have two of those reports. Laura Vernon, Sovereign Lands Planner, Utah Division of Forestry, Fire and State Lands, is going to report on mapping, groundwater quality, and chemistry adjacent to the lake. And Jake Vanderland with the Utah Division of Water Quality will talk to us about the Great Salt Lake Dust Study that was prepared by Kevin Perry. Laura, do you want to go first?
Yeah, are you okay to pass up the committee reports?
Oh, I forgot, didn't I? I was so anxious to hear what you had to say.
Oh, it's
Let's
exciting.
Go back and stay on agenda, I apologize. Okay, so the first committee report is from Leland Myers. We have two vacancies, one from Weber County. As you know, Kerry Gibbons went to the Department of Interior and was recently appointed to be head of the Department of Agriculture. And then Carl Christensen from Salt Lake County went to UTA, and they've asked Will Summercorn, his alternate, to participate until the new Salt Lake County mayor can decide. Any progress on any of those, Leland?
No, we think that we have a nomination from Weber County that's in the governor's hands, and we are hoping that by next week he will go through Senate confirmation.
Okay, that's former Representative Gage Froer, who's been nominated and likely approved. And no progress in Salt Lake County yet, is that correct?
No, and no actual pathway at the moment.
Okay.
We're not sure what Salt Lake County wants to do. They haven't responded much, and we don't know what the governor's office wants to do either. So,
okay.
Other than that, we're pretty right on top of it.
Well, thank you for bird dogging that, Leland. I appreciate that. Any questions about those membership vacancies? Okay. Let me give a brief report on the status of the two reports that we commissioned. As you know, we commissioned a report, Consequences of Drying Lake Systems Around the World. We received that final report at our March meeting. We're in the process of having an executive summary, four-page summary handout prepared, and we should have that next month. That was approved by this group, and it's consistent with the practice we've had with our major reports. As you may recall, our economic report and our Health of the Lake report, we had prepared glossy executive summaries that we could hand out so someone could get the gist of the report without having to read the full text. And so that's the stat. That's what we're doing on that report. The second project, a little more involved, on the assessment of potential costs of declining water levels of Great Salt Lake. Let me read just a brief update here. That project is being handled by Econ Northwest. They're addressing the declining lake levels and the resulting lake surface loss, increased salinity, and increased air pollution that jeopardize many of the uses of the lake and impose costs on the regional community. Excuse me. We commissioned a study to inform policy efforts regarding trade-offs between consumptive uses of water and maintenance of the Great Salt Lake. To quantify these costs, the contractor is estimating impacts of lake level declines in terms of costs, including health expenditures, lost value of cultural and economic benefits, loss of habitat for waterfowl, loss of ecosystem services, cost of mitigation, and we'll portray that in a way that assesses the costs individually and collectively for various levels of Great Salt Lake. We expect that report to be finalized. The deadline is June 30, and they seem to be on task, so we would expect at our next meeting, the July meeting, to have that report presented to us and to have someone from Econ Northwest to make that presentation. So, any questions about that?
I have a question.
Yeah,
they've been reaching out to various users and stakeholders.
But obviously they haven't talked to you yet.
No.
They are in the process of doing interviews and reviewing existing reports. They're developing their economic modeling. I can't tell you off the top of that who they have visited with, but they inform us they've had a number of interviews. But you were on the list, so we'll check and make sure they...
Can we ask a representative from US Mag?
Have you heard of contacting US Mag?
Yes, we did have a meeting.
Okay.
7 weeks ago, from back like you. Late February or March.
Well, I guess we know where you are in February, Joe. Sorry about that. We'll make sure they remedy that problem. Any other questions? Good question, Joe. All right, I'm looking forward to that report. Okay, now, research report. Thank you, Laura.
All right, so As Don said, I'm reporting on the report completed by UGS, mapping groundwater quality and chemistry adjacent to Great Salt Lake. This was research done was done by Stefan Kirby, Peter Inkenbratt, and Andrew Rupke with UGS. Their goal is to develop an ArcGIS format geodatabase of existing and select new geochemical isotopic samples of groundwater adjoining the Great Salt Lake. Their findings were that groundwater chemistry spans different significant range in both dissolved concentrations and chemistry around the lake. Variations in water type and total dissolved solids controlled by recharge and rock water interaction. Trace metal concentrations such as arsenic and selenium are generally low, but locally groundwater may contain elevated concentrations tied back to Great Salt Lake. Other metal ions, including lithium and boron, may indicate localized geothermal contributions to the groundwater system around the lake. Nutrients, including nitrate and phosphorus, occur in low concentrations near the Great Salt Lake and may only contribute locally to high nutrient concentrations. A comparison of existing chemistry from wetlands sites with groundwater chemistry may show at least a correlation between groundwater contributions to Great Salt Lake wetlands in some locations. And then finally, all of this data, new and old, is compiled into the interconnected ArcGIS geodatabase to serve as a baseline for land managers and geologists to be built upon and referenced when making land use management decisions. And that is it.
Thank you.
Yeah. I would say I don't, USGS has provided me with a report and it's posted on our Great Salt Lake Tech Team website, I do believe, and I have, can also send it to you in PDF format if you'd like to dive into it further.
Jeff?
Or what's the depth of the groundwater? I mean, how deep are they testing? You know?
I don't know how far they went. Sorry.
We'll find out for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Other questions? All
right.
Thanks, Laura. Appreciate that. Jake, you're on.
Okay. So I just wanted to give kind of an update on a Great Salt Lake dust study that was done by Dr. Kevin Perry and co-authors at the University of Utah. So Kevin did present to the council last year about some preliminary results, but since then he's submitted a final report to the tech team. Which is that available on the website
mm-hmm.
too?
Mm-hmm.
Which is also available on the tech team website. So if you want to get sort of final and deeper information, that's the place to go. So the overarching goals of that study were to identify sort of dust hot spots along the Great Salt Lake exposed lake bed, determine if the dust associated with those spots might contain potentially harmful contaminants such as heavy metals that could pose a threat to human health, and also to determine whether dust composition has been potentially altered by anthropogenic sources along the lakeshore. So to do that, they did a pretty extensive survey. So they surveyed almost 800 square miles of exposed lake bed from 2016 to 2018. They performed soil crust observations and collected soil samples at over 5,000 individual sites. And those samples were analyzed for elemental concentrations of various soil constituents. And then they identified dust hotspots throughout the lake bed, which they defined as locations with visible fine particles that could be easily displaced, sites that had little or no vegetation, and sites with a very shallow or with no surface crust. And so what they found was that there were potential hotspots pretty much all the way around the entire shoreline of the lake, and they estimated that to comprise about 9% of the exposed lake bed. They also estimated that about 73% of the lake bed is currently protected from erosion by surface crusts, and that about 15% is vegetated, and so therefore protected from erosion. They did identify a handful of elements for which samples exceeded EPA residential screening levels, so that was a total of 9 elements, but they noted that those exceedances do not necessarily identify sort of a clear health risk, because they're based on a very conservative exposure estimate. And so a more site-specific exposure study would be useful for sort of further characterizing that risk. And they also did not investigate the impact of GSL dust on general PM10, PM2.5 air quality issues. And then lastly, they did find some interesting spatial variability in some of the constituents that they suggested could indicate the presence of anthropogenic influences on soil composition around the lake bed. And just as an example, so they identified elements like copper, silver, molybdenum, and sulfur at their highest concentrations along the south shore of Great Salt Lake. And they also identified higher phosphorus concentrations in the Bear River and Farmington Bay sort of zones of their study. So and that's what I've got.
Thanks, Jay. How about questions, Dave?
Jake, to make the connection with human health, wouldn't they need monitoring sites away from the Great Salt Lake and cities and communities?
Yeah, so you know, that's not my area of expertise, but I think that's the case. You would probably want to first characterize the frequency with which that dust actually gets entrained and hits the populated areas, and then probably also measure what's actually in the dust in the air as well as where it's coming from. So yeah, it's kind of a, this is kind of a precursor for identifying things you might want to look for, I think.
Jeff?
Two questions. The phosphorus, they think that's fertilizer-based or ag-based, mostly?
That's what they said, yeah. There are multiple, of course, there's multiple sources of phosphorus right throughout the watershed, both urban and agricultural, but yeah.
And then the other, where can we find that final report? Where do we have access to that?
So it's on the tech team website, mm-hmm. Which, do you know the address for that?
It's forestry.utah.gov.
Okay.
And if you click on Great Salt Lake Research Grants, and go to the year, I think his was 2018, then it will be posted on there.
Laura, would you send email out link to Jeff?
Sure, sure. I'll email it to everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Other good questions. Other questions or comments? Laura and Jake, thank you for doing that. As a liberal arts major, I understand your presentation is much better than the original. Always helpful. And thanks for helping us get back on time. Is the written rule passing around? Okay, great, thank you. At our March meeting, we approved a project to run some lake scenarios through GSLIM/IWRM. And since that time, we went through a process, RFQ process, to select a contractor. Jacobs Engineering was selected. And today, I've asked Leland to introduce that project by talking a little bit about what we're trying to accomplish, and then Jeff Denblanker of Jacobs, how they plan to accomplish it. And I, Jeff, you'll introduce your other guests here. Great, thank you. Leland, you want to launch?
Sure. So we met as a committee, and then we met with the contractor once for the preliminary discussion. The idea is we're trying to integrate the available documents out there that talk about what we want to do to sort of protect the lake. And that would be the current water strategy that the governor's office has put together. And those in that strategy, those items in that strategy which directly affect the lake, we would want to incorporate in part of this model assessment. So we can say, if we follow the governor's strategy, what happens? And there are certain things that Zach enters into that talks about conservation, both urban as well as agricultural. It would include issues relative to, is there a Bear River project? Is there not a Bear River project? Those would all be looked at as part of this scenario process. We would also compare those scenarios to the existing Great Salt Lake Management Plan, which has a matrix that talks about when it's good and when it's not good. And it varies based upon the parameter of concern But that matrix does basically give us banding between 4195 and 4205, where most of the parameters tend to be better off than worse off. And so what we want to do is show where either no actions or additional action may lead to relative to that Great Salt Lake Management Plan in terms of water elevation. It's going to incorporate, in my opinion, a modest amount of concern over global warming that we can justify without going out on the limb and being confrontational. The outcome of the report is intended to provide us with a summary document, a final document that will sit nicely on a shelf somewhere, but a very high glossy summary document that we can utilize to go back and explain what's going to occur if we follow current or recommended practices, both in terms of conservation as well as naturally occurring changes that may take place. And that would also include population growth. The final outcome would then be utilized in conjunction with the drying lakes study as well as the economic study to form the basis to go back and say we need further action, or we don't need further action to help in terms of protecting the lake. Everybody probably here knows about House Concurrent Resolution 10, which says we're going to take an investigating look at this. We were also able, and in conjunction with this study, to try and tee up, we were able to get $500,000, $100,000 of one-time money, and the $400,000 out of the restricted fund to look at the impediments and the things that need to be done in order for some of the highest rate water conservation actions or ways to get waters to the lake that we put together would take to achieve or to do. And so that would then work in conjunction with this to say if we were able to do this, and that would be further modeling that won't be done in this round, but could be done, saying if we're able to do this, what does it do in terms of lake elevation? Does it help us? Does it help us a little or does it help us a lot? So that's the concept that we're, and the construct we're working under. Again, target audience is the legislature, governor's office, those who have to make these key decisions. We know that water resources would like to have a few tweaks in the starting process. We're working on that, make sure it looks consistent with the other documents that are out there. And so those are now taking place in discussions on that. With that in mind.
Thank you very much, Leland. Leland mentioned it. First of all, Leland deserves the lion's share of the credit for getting this put together and characterized and moving forward. So thank you for chairing our committee.
Oh, you bet.
Leland mentioned this committee. It includes Tom Ward, Dan Tuttle, Jeff Richards, myself. We have some folks from the state involved, Laura and Jake, of course, Craig Miller, Candace Hosniager, and Krishna Khatri from the Division of Water Resources. And then Tim Hawks and Ann DeVille have been in an advisory role. In addition to Jeff Denblaker, we have Paula Silva and Armin Munavar of Jacobs who are involved in the project. So a good team. I will mention that immediately following this advisory council meeting, that committee is going to meet in this room. It's a public meeting, so you can stick around if you want, but if you're not sticking around, we'll ask you to hit the door after you've signed the roll. So thank you, Leland. Jeff, why don't you...
Can I ask one question? Yeah. Can you repeat again that the $500,000 appropriations, that's for future studies? And
We're working together with the coalition of the publicly owned treatment works and the lobbyists that we've hired, we were able to go back and request, we took the, as many of you probably know, we took a group of legislators out of the lake to show them and discuss the concept of what level and the impacts that it may recreate. And then we went back and requested funding to look at how we're going to address this issue of of the drying of the lake and what we can do relative to the study that was put together by the council by and that was done a year and a half ago.
The 72 strategies?
Yeah, the 72 SWCA. That we whittled down to about a dozen.
SWCA.
SWCA, but we it's been completed and we had about a dozen that we said were the high priority. We would then utilize those to say what are the impediments to being able to do those items in order to deliver water out of the lake. And then work on that. The study also included the $500,000 that we also sold it to the legislature based on the fact that we wanted to look at how the bays are interconnected. We often talk about Great Salt Lake and then we talk about individual bays, but we don't necessarily draw the conclusions as to how those interconnections change how the lake functions. And so we want to have some work done on a summary of the interconnections of the bays and what that means. You know, if you do something in one bay, what does it do to the next bay?
Thank you. So we'll come back to this legislation a little bit later. We have a section today on our agenda. Let's go ahead, Jeff.
All right. Well, thanks for the opportunity to work with you on this project. We're excited and we plunged in feet first. I want to introduce Armin Mudabar and Paula Silva from our San Diego office. They're really the wizards kind of who put together the Great Salt Lake integrated model that we're going to be using for this project. As you know, I've shown you this slide before, but the need, the real driver for developing the model was to understand how changes in future water supply really trickle down and affect the lake. So we're looking at the lake, but we're trying to understand from a bigger picture standpoint, bigger context, how does what we do in the watershed affect the lake? And that was what the primary driver for developing the model several years ago. So the challenge that we're looking at right now, and a lot of this repeating, I think, what Leland was saying is, you know, how can we characterize and understand how all the different variables that represent the watershed, how do those influence the Great Salt Lake and how the lake responds to them? How can we explore future uncertainty to make informed decisions? You know, as you look at all the different things that are happening in the watershed, and you start to look out into the future, there's a lot of different variables that contribute to some significant uncertainty as to what might occur in the future. So we're trying to get our arms around that. And what management options appear to be the most promising? So those are some of the key challenges that we're trying to do here. And then the question that I've been asked hundreds of times is, what does the model tell us? And that's where we hope to really get our arms around that to present that to you and in the documents that Leland mentioned. So the approach that we're taking here, you've heard scenario planning before, but really what we're trying to do is we're trying to characterize this complex interplay between these incredibly complicated natural systems, but then all the influences that we as people have within that watershed, you know, throughout the entire area. Scenario planning lets us identify what are the key drivers of change, so which elements that we do in the watershed really, or the natural system, affect the lake. It lets us look at some plausible features. So there's, of all these hundreds, thousands of variables, what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, rather than trying to evaluate one at a time, we're trying to look out into the future and see that cone, trying to say, well, what are some plausible features that make sense, that cover that spectrum, so we can really try to understand, well, what, you know, what are the drivers, what are the consequences, risks, and then ideally identify some solutions that can get us on the right trajectory. And then, as I just mentioned, just identifying a near-term strategy, identifying a roadmap where we have some decision points where we know, okay, we don't, you know, in 5 years or 20 years, we need to have some information so that we can make some informed decisions. So the schedule we have is in, I didn't count how many weeks, but June 28th, we need to be hands off. So we've got just 2 months to do this project. And so rather than going through and developing, you know, doing an extensive study to develop scenarios, we're really basing those on existing literature, existing discussions that you as a council and stakeholders have had over the years that we can include in the model and come up with some output for it. And what we're trying to do today with the subcommittee after this meeting is we pulled together, I'll show you kind of our straw man scenario matrix. We're going to go through that with them, try to finalize that so that we can then start really cranking on developing the model so we can then evaluate some of the solutions. So our first task is scenario development. We're already doing literature review, just trying to document what the options are, what some realistic numbers should that we could use. We're hoping to get input on those today from the committee. There's lots of different variables in the model from the watershed standpoint, looking at climate, population, water operations, water use conservation, both the municipal, industrial, and agricultural, transbasin diversions, the diversions that Central Utah Project's been making for decades, but then also considering the Bear River Project in the future. On the Great Salt Lake stamp, the model includes the West Desert Pump Station, mineral extraction. We can look at different causeway reach configurations, looking at the duck clubs, the other shoreline impoundments, what kinds of areas, what kind of vegetation is there out there, how might that, how can, what does the changes in that vegetation affect the lake? And primarily the focus there and including in the model is, well, what if we were able to get rid of Phragmites? Does that, what kind of influence does that have? So lots of variables that allow us to tweak and look at many, many different questions. But what we wanted to do is make sure that our scenarios are really driven by potential strategies that are already being discussed. And so we were just looking at the various reports. Of course, there's the Great Salt Lake Comprehensive Management Plan that identifies management strategies and that matrix that Leland mentioned. There's the definition and assessment of Great Salt Lake Health that this council funded and completed. There's economic significance of Great Salt Lake that the council completed. In 2017, the recommended state water strategy was published, so we're incorporating that. 2018 was the Water for Great Salt Lake document that was just mentioned. The consequences of drying lakes that just came out a few months ago. And then, as was mentioned, the potential cost of declining water levels of Great Salt Lake that is still being worked on. So all of these different things provide us a tremendous amount of input, vision, ideas, and the challenge really is when we're doing planning projects like this is how do we pull it together? How do we see, you know, how do we compare these different scenarios, these different strategies? And so that's really the basis of how the Great Salt Lake Integrated Model was designed, is to be able to compare the results from different scenarios or different plausible future conditions. If you've had the opportunity to read the recommended state water strategy, there are a lot of great ideas in there covering a whole wide range of different topics. And there's different questions that you can see on the left that they addressed. I greatly simplified that and just identifying some of the key strategies that were recommended. From educating and updating policy legal frameworks, considering changing weather and climate, improving water conservation, completing better informed, integrated, holistic water resource management, improved flexibility, incentives, protections for transfers of water to try to get keep more water for downstream users and the environment, and assessing potential consequences of decisions. So all of these, you know, dozens of strategies, I try to lump those and try to simplify those into this pie graph that we wanted to try to incorporate into this study. The Water for Great Salt Lake report that was finished last year by SWCA, and all of you provided a lot of great input to, came up with, as Don mentioned, 72 different strategies, and the council prioritized and ranked the top 12, I don't know, there's 15 or so. And really, again, boiling those down, some of the key strategies really were looking at how can we acquire or transfer more conserved water and get that to the Great Salt Lake? What are some methods that we can do that? Ag water conservation, M&I water conservation, organizational educational improvements, understanding health and ecological impacts from future change, and then reducing water loss from plants or Phragmites. And trying to identify different studies, different strategies that the council and stakeholders can try to push forward. And so what we wanted to try to do is we wanted to try to incorporate all this information with a model to try to develop some scenarios. And so as part of our proposal, we threw out a straw man some scenarios. And the scenarios are intended to capture the strategy, but really looking at different levels of implementation. So the baseline or business as usual strategy is just that we continue doing what we're doing. Cooperative growth is, you know, getting people engaged but not making huge investments in change. Adaptive innovation is really where we start to make some significant investments to change how we manage water, how we use water. And then hot growth is intended to really kind of capture a bookend on the other end of what happens if we do have significant climate change, what if we aren't conserving water, what if we have significant growth and we're not doing much, you know, we're doing some water conservation but not a lot. So really trying to grapple with, well, what happens if we look at the spectrum of different responses in water management and climate conditions. The different drivers that we're going to be looking at, obviously the population is a big driver for water use. These are all, we're in flux changing some of these. These were just our initial ideas. But obviously we want to be using the 2017 population projections that the governor's offices recently put out. On climate, as Leland said, we're going to be looking at, you know, historical conditions, and we're going to be looking at and talking about, well, what are some appropriate climate assumptions that we should could include in the model to look at what kind of water supply might we have. On the municipal industrial conservation here, our thoughts were Division of Water Resources just put out a draft document with water conservation goals and scenarios. That would be a very good place for us to start to look at, well, how we look at business as usual or baseline versus looking at where we are significantly reducing our water use. How does that affect things? Agricultural conservation, you know, kind of just playing with the dials to try to look at, well, what happens if we're able to reduce our depletions or from agricultural areas. And then cloud seeding, and this is something that was mentioned, is what if we can increase our precipitation in our watersheds and make additional investments in that? How does that influence things? So those are, I guess, that's our straw man that we're going to be looking at and further refining here in the next week or so. And so I'm trying to get input from folks. Then we're going to be updating the model to be able to address all of those effectively, revising some of the input and output interfaces so that they're easier to get at rather than having to dive under the hood. And then trying to understand how each of the variables, how each of these things do. You've seen Krishna just talked about the model last month, I believe, and we'll be able to use the model to characterize all these changes. But then what about the output? And that's really task three. We're hoping by the end of May we'll have most of the modeling done, and then we hopefully spend the next 3 weeks in June really talking about, well, what does this really mean? And trying to characterize that and get some meaningful output for all of you, but also for the legislature to absorb and really digest and think about. So one of the suggestions that's been made is just, you know, we've got a great matrix here with a lot of detail looking at all the different aspects of the lake and how the different lake levels affect the quality, the performance of all these different variables. One of the things that we've talked about is if we can present our results in context of this matrix, and if we're able to look at, you know, 42, I guess this is the straw man, is that middle sweet spot of 4198 to 4205 is kind of our green zone. The shoulder areas from 4195 up to 4208 are kind of a yellow zone. And then, you know, 4188 to 4212 is an orange zone. And that way we at least have some benchmarks where we can try to characterize, rather than because there's so much information on the matrix, at least this is one way we can make that, facilitate the connection back. So this is a run that we did a few, when we were developing a model several years ago. And here you can see how those results might be presented. I mean, we're already in that orange zone, being below 4195. But then you can see just the probabilities of where we might go when we look into the future. So that's just one mechanism that we're looking at. But then also, how do we communicate all of this detail? And one of the, I guess we put together this just as an example fact sheet where you can compare the different scenarios side by side to look at, well, what does, you know, in the upper corner, you know, each scenario is defined by these different variables, but then you can look at, you know, how does the population change and salinity down here, just showing how shoreline habitat might change for the different scenarios, lake level, salinity, kind of all on one page. There's a lot of information on one page, but those are the kinds of things that we'll be talking about as we do this. So some of the key outputs that we are anticipating are obviously lake level, salinity, how much of exposed playa or mud flats is there at the different for the different scenarios, distance to the water, wetland areas, shallow water habitat, you know, how much pumping is required to the West Desert, and then from a watershed standpoint, understanding, well, how do these different scenarios affect the river flows, and then depletions, how much water are we pulling out of the system and using, depleting by river basin and overall, just to try to understand how those are. So anyway, that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions for Jeff or Leland? I tend, those of you who know me, I tend to be a glass half empty person. But I'm a glass half full person about this. And you, those of you who were around when we were talking about creating a model years and years ago, and then went with a couple of state agencies to the Hill and got some money to create GSLIM, we call it IWRM at the time. Isn't this what we're envisioning? A tool where you could plug in real life scenarios, alternatives and options, and see what comes out the other end. And I think we're on the cusp of that, and so I'm excited about this this work. And thanks, Leland and
I just wanted to second what you said. That is really tremendous that this model's come this far and we're using it. And think of where we started, we just envisioning this a long time ago. My question is, as you develop the scenarios, and I'm thinking, frankly, of Envision Utah that did the same sort of thing, you know, current growth, major growth, you know, out of off the chart growth. There's also an implication of, if we make these choices, this will happen. And I wonder if that's the type of report will come out, not just, you know, if so much rainfall happens, this will happen, but if we make these choices in agriculture or as in municipal planning for cities or in other ways. So in other words, there's kind of a choice that's presented in addition just to the data.
And that's the intent of scenario planning, is to be able to compare those different types of choices. And, you know, depending on the choice that you want to look at, you know, may mean, you know, different modifications needed in the model. But I think with the scenarios that we've identified, given the model that we have, given all these different strategies, I guess we're trying to, on a big picture standpoint, with a broad brush, trying to say, okay, well, here's the key strategies that have been discussed, and I guess we're trying to take that first cut of, well, what, you know, when we look at those different scenarios, we want to compare, well, what does that mean? And I think, and the intent is, this is not the definitive answer, this is just to, I guess, kind of grease the skids, try to, you know, start the process of those kind of analyses.
And it can be so complex with dozens of different tweaks that you say what this little tweak does and the whole these constants. So there's going to be some generalities that are going to have to be put into it. The idea is, you know, if we can do what was in the recommended water strategy, find a way to make those work in conservation that's being talked about at the Division of Water Resources occurs. You know, where does that lead us? And then perhaps, what would we need to get it better in terms of lake level? Or if we do nothing, how bad does it really look like it'll go? And we saw some of that last council meeting when they were presenting some of the earlier, or some of the recent model runs showing that it could go way down.
Actually, I think an important part of value that this kind of a scenario planning process provides is it helps you prioritize where you do need to make investments to do further study. So rather than kind of like we think this is important to study this, is the intent is to be able to look at it from a broad brush standpoint and say, well, you know, what are the most important drivers? And, you know, if we need to get into a tremendous amount of detail on just the climate component, you know, then, well, this should be able to tell us, well, that's a huge part of this. And maybe we need to invest more money to investigate that and refine our understanding there. Or, you know, what's going through the breach? You know, we're already doing that, but something like this can tell us, you know, does that make much of a difference in what we observe or not? So it's not intended to be predictive, you know, and say, well, I'm going to be within 6 inches of this in 40 years. The intent is to be able to compare these different scenarios.
Tom and Lynn?
Just following on what Jeff said and Leyland in terms of how I see this helping the state, Division of Water Resources and others, is there's some decisions as we map out the next decade or two of where we invest in water resources projects, right? Is it developing new sources? Is it how much is conservation? Right now, the state is relying on the best information that they have. This study will hopefully show, you know, well, if we're gonna invest $500 million in a new development project, but we invest $500 million in efficiency in agriculture, which one's gonna produce more water? So we're able to, still you're gonna spend money on developing water resources, but what's the best way to do that? And if you can do that and also monetize the impacts, not only the least cost of where that investment goes, but the least impact to the Great Salt Lake and the extractive industries and the habitat and all the other stakeholders, then it's a way of, you're still spending the same amount of money, but you're doing more good things with that. And it provides that clarity, at least a range of, you know, a window of clarity, if you will, of these, like you said, cause and effect. I think that will really be helpful to our legislature, our governor, our state agencies that are doing really good work. But there's a window of time where some of these options might be cheap and affordable now, but they won't be options in 10, 20 years.
Water resources, what is the status of the report on the conservation goals for M&I?
That is a great question. So the current status is we sent it up to the governor's office and have been working through some of their concerns and issues. So currently I don't have a potential release date on when it will be available for public comment, but as soon as I do know, I'll let you guys know. We should probably have that a little bit more defined in the next couple weeks, so that gives you some basis to know when to expect when we will announce when that'll be open for public comment.
Thank you.
Yes, of course.
One more question or comment?
Ellen, could this be on the presentation to be put on line somewhere?
This presentation?
We can do that.
Put it on our side. Is that okay? All right, great. Well, thank you so much. Again, I'm excited about the outcome here. We did authorize this project at our March meeting. Since then, we completed the RFQ process, selected Jacobs. They came in under budget. In order to follow the state purchasing process that we chose, it allowed us to move quickly. There was a $95,000 limit on what could be spent on this project. Jacobson came in under budget. Sorry to tell you, Jeff, you left $13 on the table.
He could have
gone 13 high. still qualified, so.
Drinks are on Jeff.
Check one for the government, right? We saved $13 today. Anyway, I'd appreciate it if the council would adopt a motion to formally ratify the selection of the contractor and the commitment of those funds. Someone willing to do that? Thank you, Dan. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you very much, Leland. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. Thank you. Tim, why don't you come up and while we're doing the transition here to the next topic.
Thank you, President.
Okay. I wanted to give Nick around a second to those of you who have participated in the Bird Festival know what an outstanding event that is. It happens because of the leadership of Davis County and the great work of Nick and her team. So would you just give us a brief report on what's
I'm inviting you all next week to Great Salt Lake Bird Festival just out at the end of Glover's Lane, and we're being hosted by the Eccles Wildlife Education Center. It's brand new, and Don mentioned about perhaps making meetings there later, but that's where we're holding Bird Festival this year, right on the edge of the lake where the birds are. We invite you to come out on Saturday, May 18th, and enjoy the free workshops, and Friday night, the night before, our keynote speaker is giving a free family presentation on cartooning 101, doing birds. And Saturday we've got a lot of fun workshops, live birds, and it's all Saturday's free to the public. So bring your families out and enjoy the birds.
So there's a free a few field trips still left.
We have a few field trips open on Saturday, May 18th. Burrowing owls and Farmington Bay. Great field trips. Cool. Thank you.
Find information, you're online.
GreatSaltLakeBirdFest.com. We got it a long time ago when you had to have short words. So Great Salt Lake Bird Fest. Chicken
Fest.
Yeah, we got chicken coming for the dinner.
All right. Thank you, Nika. Next item on the agenda is the legislative wrap-up. At our March meeting, we had a very brief comment on the passage of HCR 10 that Leland alluded to again. We promised a broad report on legislation related to Great Salt Lake, so Tim, would you provide that for us?
I'd be happy to. Thanks, Don. So there's more than you might think, so I'm going to run through this fairly quickly. We'll start out with a metaphor for the legislative session. I'll leave it to you to decide whether the legislators are firefighters or are the dumpster fire. Many of you have heard about HCR 10. I don't believe it too much, but I do want to talk about it because it's the most direct and most immediate sort of affecting Great Salt Lake. It has a long title, but it really is focused on declining water levels. We could debate the value of making resolutions. this is actually a pretty good one. I was the sponsor, and Scott Sandel, who represents Tooele and Box Elder counties, was the Senate sponsor. Just point out that it's what we call a concurrent resolution. So you can have a resolution from a single house, a House resolution or a Senate resolution. You have a joint resolution from both houses. A concurrent resolution just has the governor's consent, so it kind of shows that the governor buys into the result as well. And while a lot of bills that run through the legislative session have broad support, it is rare sometimes to get one that's truly unanimous where it doesn't drop a single vote. There's usually somebody who can find a reason to vote against it. But it was nice to see in this instance that it was unanimous in every committee hearing in both House and Senate. So I think the big picture value of this, and I really think Marcel Shoup and Audubon deserve a lot of credit really for fleshing this concept out and pushing it forward. But the significance is kind of captured in the what we call the short title and the description up front, but it emphasizes, or the resolution sort of calls out, the critical importance of continued water flows to Great Salt Lake and the fact that we need solutions to address them. And that those solutions should have certain features, right? They should be balanced among these various needs. I don't think the resolution's not Pollyanna-esque in the sense of just pretending you can wave a magic wand and solve these issues. And then it calls for expeditious, so let's act quickly in collaborative solutions. I'll talk a little bit later about kind of how that fleshed out in the body of the resolution. But basically, we've got to do something. So one of the ways I sort of saw this resolution is the first step to solving the problem is recognizing and admitting that there is a problem. A little bit of Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe. But the idea here was really just kind of build a foundation that you could build later policy directions and things on top of. But before we do that, we really have to have the legislature sort of buy in and say, hey, this is a problem that needs to be addressed. So the resolution teases out the value of the Great Salt Lake in terms of its economic, its environmental, and sort of its impacts to Utah's quality of life, whether it's air quality and things like that. It talks about that these values are at risk, they're under threat, and specifically referenced other terminal lake basins around the world, which sort of highlight what happens if you fail to address these issues proactively. It's really bad for all of those values. And then last, it just, without being too prescriptive about what to do, it just says we need a policy to protect water supply, and then it calls on the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Quality to work with stakeholders, develop recommendations, and then report back by November 30th, 2020. So that, in essence, is what the resolution does. Almost all pieces of legislation have a few hiccups, and I wanted to point out just a couple. The first one came out fairly early, and it was interest in Bear Lake that saw this as a threat. So they figured that any additional water supply at Great Salt Lake had to be bad for Bear Lake. And so they came up with their own resolution, which initially sort of teed this up as a zero-sum game, right? What's good for these folks has got to be bad on the other. It didn't overtly state that, but that's just kind of the optics of how it looked. Fortunately, we have Jody Williams, some other folks step in that really have expertise in this whole system. I think put that on a much more collaborative track where we recognize that this is a shared resource between these two. And so what we wound up with was two resolutions, one that recognizes the value of the Great Salt Lake, the other recognizes the value of Bear Lake, and there's an understanding there that these are both valuable resources that we need to protect. The other thing I'd point out is just we did have some in the agricultural community. They're always concerned when you talk about water supply because they control 80% of it. And so one of the things we did, some wordings that we changed in the resolution, was just to do some call out to agriculture in terms of talking about the value of production agriculture in the basin of the Great Salt Lake, and also that they would play a role in finding any solution. So we threw some language in that, and that helped really grease the skids for this resolution as we move through. So changing gears or shifting gears a little bit, one that's maybe a little less direct but still important, that's the joint resolution supporting the study of water banking. Water banking has been in the mix, I don't want to say for as long as I've been involved in water, but for a long time. It's been identified as a key strategy for how to manage water in the face of scarcity to meet a lot of competing demands. And so it figured prominently in the state water strategy that you've heard alluded to. Today, Senator Iwamoto, two or three years ago, had an in-stream flow bill that was kind of aimed at trying to expand the in-stream flow statute. At the same time, I was running a kind of a collaborative group really looking at optimization in agricultural water. Both of those groups sort of independently started saying, what we really should be talking about, what's really ripe right now to talk about, is water banking. And that's led to a lot of engagement and a lot of dialogue on water banking. The Utah Water Task Force has now really been working on this for 2 years. It was recognized that last session there was not, that the draft legislation was not ready for prime time. But the thought was, hey, why don't we run a resolution that helps start to educate policymakers and the public on water banking? And paired with it is a $400,000 appropriations request designed to be paired with the Water Smart grant through the Bureau of Reclamation, to just test drive what a water bank might look like, what a couple of water banks might look like in the state of Utah. So Senator Iwamoto pushed that through with Representative Barlow. I went looking for, apropos pictures, as I want to do, and all I could find is one about water and one about banks. So that's about as good as I could do on the slides. Anyway, that one passed, non-controversial, was an opportunity for education. I will say, going back to HCR 10 and its educational component, one of the things I did is sometimes in a resolution, a committee hearing just wants to hear these, wham, bam, get them done. But I had sort of insisted the committee slow down, and we actually went through the presentations on HCR 10. Water banking was similar in terms of just really providing a great opportunity to educate policymakers on these issues, more than the policy itself. So one that, I'm glad, did Casey walk in? I see Casey over there. Oh, he stepped up, all right. HCR 23, this deals with the Class A, the Class 5, I don't know where Class A landfill came from. But this is a resolution that's repealing another resolution, and Representative Snyder, who just walked in, was the sponsor. I'm glad he's here so I can give him crap, because this is a case of a reluctant sponsor. I think that's about as much as Representative Snyder enjoyed running this bill, which managed to put him between a lot of people throwing rocks at him. A little bit of just a history, and this is, again, the proposed Class 5 landfill out on Promontory, and I wanted to just give you a little bit of the historical context on that. In 2011, it was approved as a Class 1 landfill. That's in-state waste, largely municipal waste, kind of a dump, right? The kind of things you think about when you think about a dump. In Utah law, if you change that to a Class 5, then you have a whole different set of approvals that have to happen, at environmental quality, and also the legislature has to bless the move to a Class 5. Interestingly enough, the waste stream is the same in the sense that they can accept the same type of things. The difference is a Class 5 can accept out-of-state waste, and so we're talking about much bigger volumes than you otherwise might. That raises policy implications and why the legislature is involved. In 2016, a bill came to the legislature and they said, listen, this is imminent, we've got to do it, it's important for Box Elder County, it's worth a lot of money to Box Elder County, so let's do it. So that legislation, that resolution passed unanimously. They got bonding approval, but then we had problems with the application dealing with this. And that application was ultimately withdrawn. There currently is no pending application for a Class 5 permit on Promontory. I can say fairly that the vast majority of legislators felt hoodwinked by the 2016 bill. They felt like they were sold, for lack of a better word, a bill of goods. They were told it was imminent, it's not imminent, it was withdrawn, and so there's still a lot of residual kind of resentment about that cart before the horse legislative approval that went through in 2016. So enter HGR 23 in 2019 that said effectively, we're withdrawing our approval, and if you want to bring it back, you can bring it back later. And initially it had that. I think there was an amended version ultimately that sort of pushed that out to sort of give the proponents an opportunity to resubmit their, refile their application, but ultimately this bill failed for lack of Senate consideration, and so currently the approval, at least the legislative approval, stands, but we don't have a live application, and we still have state approval that would have to occur before this could be approved as Class 5. So that's that resolution. Not all bills go exactly as planned, just like this family photo shoot on the beach didn't go exactly as planned. The bill, and I think it's an important one, it is important for the lake and for water supply writ large, is dealt with secondary water metering. Senator Jake Andrade picked this up a few years ago. I ran it with him on the House side this year. And we've talked about this one in this group, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. Just, let's just say that a lot of water is at stake in the lack of secondary metering. Particularly in northern Utah. Enormous volumes of water, 40,000 acre feet is one estimate. That's a whole lot of water that you could save simply by metering, measuring basically what people are using for their outdoor watering, their untreated secondary water. I wanted to point out the original bill and then the amended bill, which did pass. The original bill basically said all new secondary has to be metered by July 1st of 2019, so here just in a couple of months. That was amended in the bill to push that out to April 1st, 2020.
The original bill called for meters on all secondary connections by 2030. That was lost in the bill that ultimately passed. That proved too much of a sticking point. Both bills have reports, basically, where you have to report back to water rights. The first one is how you plan to get there by 2030. That was replaced with basically report on how you do it and what it would cost you. Again, the problem and the challenge with secondary metering has always been cost. To implement statewide, it would be, with using current technologies, probably on the order of about $250 million to fully implement secondary metering. One thing that was lost from the original to the amended, and I tell a lot of those municipalities who are complaining about this that didn't want to see this happen, there was originally money on the table to help them make that happen. One of the things that came out in negotiations eventually, they said, listen, this has got to be user pays, so it's going to be loans only. So probably subsidized government loans through existing programs, but we're not going to have a grant component to it, and there was a grant component in the original version. Okay, one last one, not quite ready for prime time, watershed councils. I think that's because the makeup of the councils is still being debated, whether the cat's wearing soup cuffs on their head is still being debated. But this was one, I actually opened this bill file. There's been discussion on this. There was draft legislation, but it was understood that it wasn't ready for prime time again. But I think that bill is getting awfully close. And this is, again, a part of the state water strategy. If you look around the West, watershed councils, some of which are highly informal, much like the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council is formal in the sense that it's constituted by legislation, but it's not formal in the sense of having basically regulatory or rulemaking type authority, right? And so one of the debates is, if you have a watershed council, what does it look like? In the West, many times it's just stakeholders getting together to manage water in the face of scarcity. And they find that absent the formal rulemaking, they can get a lot done. If they understand and they provide a forum for stakeholders to talk to each other, we can deliver water in this watershed to this crucial need right now. We can do so informally and flexibly. And so the idea is, hey, we need to sort of figure this out for Utah. What does this look like? It's in the recognized, the strategy. It's been under work for some time. And I think in 2020, we're going to see a final bill. Now, this one is a mouthful. And this is, let me just say, is a work in progress. The proposed bill essentially would create watershed councils in, I think it's about 14 basins in the state of Utah. The one of them that's unique and that's caused, I think, more contention and debate is, what would a Great Salt Lake Watershed Council look like? And that's because the Great Salt Lake is made up of multiple watersheds. So how do you get these watersheds to talk to each other? Initial versions had representation from these other watershed councils, and it was about half and half, and then the rest was actually designated by this group, by the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council. There was some concerns expressed about that. Ultimately, I think they tried to do a kitchen sink approach, which was to call out and have representations from all the folks that are interested in the Great Salt Lake. You can see some of them are awkwardly put together. Like, I love, my favorite one is birding/boating yes, interests. And another one that interests is the conservation interest is jointly selected by the directors of DEQ, Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, and the Division of Wildlife Resources. Bottom line is, what they're trying to do here is come up with a fairly representative group that can get together and informally try to manage water supplies within the Great Salt Lake watershed in a positive and collaborative way, to share information, to share strategies, to do different things like that. So this is concept still. If people have ideas and suggestions on how better to skin this cat or how to have a more fairly representative body. But if it works like the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council, if it works like the Water Task Force, which are statutorily created but are largely left to organically solve problems, that's not the end of the world, and a formal seat on the table is not so important as just creating a venue for dialogue. Let me wrap up with just mentioning briefly a couple of appropriations requests. One is mentioned, $400,000 did go through for water banking. That would be paired with the Water Smart grant for almost $1 million to test water banking. And then, thanks to Leland, we had really a push for some additional money for Great Salt Lake Research. $400,000 of that came out of Sovereign Lands Trust account, and $100,000 out of the general fund. So some significant appropriations that benefit or the lake directly or indirectly. And that's it. It was just a couple minutes for quick questions if somebody.
Let's put it on our slide. I feel like that bird's looking right at me.
So I have a motion to move off of that slide.
In the movie, the bird.
No,
I think it's a kutu. Anybody?
I don't know.
Any questions for Representative Hawks?
Yeah, do you have cats, Timothy?
Oh, sorry?
Do you have cats? Is that why you're using cats all the time?
Cats?
Cats.
No, I actually don't have cats. I have a dog. That's a good question.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have compass soup cups left over?
No, I'm just kidding.
What was the major sticking point to cause that to be not ready for prime time? What was the major?
You know, I think the real challenge with secondary water metering is you're going to many of these small water providers and you're telling them that they have to incur a bunch of costs without any obvious benefit for the people that pay the bills, right? The benefits are abstract. It benefits the Great Salt Lake. It's the right thing to do. It provides you with information. But the costs are enormous, particularly where these water providers in many cases have figured out ways through gravity-fed systems to provide water incredibly cheaply. So some people are paying $40, $50, $60, $70 for an entire irrigation system. That's all they pay. And if you tell them now that they have to invest $1,800 per hookup in a secondary meter, that's where you get the friction.
One just follow up.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the watershed councils, I mean, why would that impact that? And what's their major sticking point? Because so they get cheap water, why would they not want to participate in watershed?
So watershed councils, to be clear, watershed councils didn't fail. It wasn't even introduced.
It wasn't ready for prime time.
Yeah, it wasn't introduced. Well, I think there wasn't enough agreement on how those watershed councils were constituted. But two separate bills, and not really, you know, one didn't get caught up in the other one, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I wanted to thank Representative Snyder for sponsoring House Resolution 23. Take a little flack over pushing that as far as it got. But mostly, I want to give you an opportunity to take a shot back at Representative. It was quite gratuitous what he did.
It's not the first time, it won't be the last, so I just deal with it.
All right. I'll smack you back.
No, it was fine. And it's unfortunate that the Salt Lake, the landfill, excuse me, resolution was not able to move the entire way. Some of the dynamics there, at least in the amendments that I made on it on the floor, were related to local opposition to the resolution we were running. So obviously there's interests with the lake that were supportive of the initial draft. When that came out, every county commissioner in Box Elder County opposed the resolution. So the compromise date was meant to not alienate an entire county, which I don't represent. So that was sort of the interest or the motivation behind making some of those changes. And ultimately, there were some dynamics in the Senate that just didn't allow it to go the entire route. But I, having gone through that, I am optimistic that some sort of the time will come up with a solution that may be more amicable in the end. That's sort of how I feel that this will sort itself out. But there's one other thing that I think is worth highlighting. It was a bill that the Waterfowl Association supported that created a new waterfowl management area on Willard Spur. And that was a big push from the Waterfowl Association, but also supported by Audubon and many of the others in this room. That creates, to me, some new precedent, which I think in the long-term conversation with lakes can be important. Basically, there is now a waterfowl management area on the Great Salt Lake, which is not managed and is not diked. It's the first of its kind on the lake, and it's on the most productive portion of the lake, biologically, on Willard Spur. So, that's something I think worth flagging for long-term protection of life and something like that. So, anyway, and Tim's slides are always like this. They're always ridiculous, and somehow I end up bearing the brunt of his, you know, whatever.
Such an inviting target.
There you go.
Well, thanks to both representatives for being here. Appreciate that.
I just want there's a wonderful levity and good energy in these presentations, but I just want to acknowledge, having been on the council for many years, this is a sea change to have these great legislators, Representative Hawks and Snyder, working on these issues is unbelievable. We've never had a presentation even close to this, and the progress has been made. I just wanted to applaud both of them.
Thank you. Well spoken. Appreciate that. Any other questions or comments about the legislature?
Don, let me just say really quick. Todd reminded me there was $3 million appropriated for agricultural water optimization, which furthers that whole effort. I think this is going to be important for the lake in this future.
Great. Thank you. A lot of activity.
Yeah.
Okay. It's our practice of these meetings to allow public comment. I'd like to know how many people, if any, would like to make a public comment so I know how much time to give you. Anyone want to address the council? Lynn, anyone else?
Marcel.
Marcel, okay. 2 or 3 minutes each, is that good?
Sure. I was just wondering what the status of the Great Salt Lake Salinity Advisory Committee is.
The RFP is being written as we speak. And go out to bid probably in the next week or two. So once that process closes and we get a contractor underway to help us initiate that, they'll have a 5-year contract and we'll just be able to move forward with them facilitating the group.
Great.
So we'll reconvene them probably in a month or two. That's what I hope.
Where are we in the 5-year window for the adaptive management plan? Is that it, or whatever it's called?
Year two.
For the causeway?
I think we're starting year three,
starting
right?
Year three.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention also, on May the 15th, Friends of Great Salt Lake is going to have their Doyle Stevens Scholarship Program at Westminster College in the Gore Auditorium. We will be giving 2 scholarships this year, one for a grad level and one for undergrad level. So please come if you're available, 6 to 9 p.m. Thank you.
Location?
Westminster College, Gore Auditorium.
Thank you, Lynn. Marcel, you're on.
Thanks. I could have jumped in maybe when you guys were talking about the legislation, but I just wanted to mention Representative Hawks gave a number of very passionate presentations in trying to push the Great Salt Lake Resolution through, but he also helped educate, as he said, a number of legislators as well as other folks up there that were lobbying to have the resolution passed. And if you're interested, you know, many of the Senate and House hearings have their recordings online. The House passage of that resolution actually had a number of speakers from around the counties representing the counties around the lake actually saying some really positive things about Great Salt Lake and protecting the importance of the resolution. So I would just recommend it, and I'm happy to send the link through to Laura or something.
Tim uses cat slides when he spoke to legislators.
I think it was an Iranian president at one time.
Oh, we had the Ayatollah Khomeini. He made it.
Thanks, Marcel. Thanks for the work on
this. Thank you. Thank the council for pushing it forward, too.
Okay, any other public comments? And I'll close the public comment period. Are there any other recommendations or actions or issues that members of the council would like to raise or discuss? Again, thank you for being here. Our next meeting is the second Wednesday of July. That'll be July 10th. It'll be here or downstairs or out at the Eccles Center. We'll let you know. That will be an important agenda. We'll receive the executive summary of the Declining Lakes report. We'll receive the final report of the cost of a declining lake levels at Great Salt Lake. And then we'll receive the results of running the scenarios through GSLIM iWorm. So, I told you that.
You just need to stop that one. Right, Craig?
That works again now?
He just needs to stop referring to the eye worm.
That's what I told him.
GSLIM and the IWRM.
G-Slim's good.
Okay. Well, if you use one, you got to use the other. Anyway, so it'll be an important meeting, and I hope you'll plan to be here. The remaining meetings for 2019 are September 11th and November 13th. Again, thanks for being here. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. Thank you, Randy. Is there a second?
Second.
Nobody wants to leave. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed, nay? Any abstentions? It's unanimous.